Washington, January 20th, the 773rd day of the war. Raymond Graham Swing reviews history on the march. A friendly dealer at the sign of the Flying Red Horse. Across the Pacific, a formation of American heavy bombers returns from one of the longest bombing missions ever attempted. The veteran pilot leans back and says, "Those Japs never knew what hit them. Quite a difference from the old days. We never thought we'd be hauling such bomb loads as far as we did today." No, and neither did the enemy. But today, American bombers can carry enormous cargoes of death and destruction because of improved engines utilizing the power of 100-octane gasoline. And now, these planes are getting a sensational new gasoline, a gasoline of flying horsepower, so powerful its octane rating cannot be measured. Flying horsepower, the result of Zirconi Vacuum's revolutionary new refining process, is speeding the day of victory. And when victory is won, you'll find flying horsepower in mobile gas at the sign of the Flying Red Horse. Now, Mr. Swing from Washington.
Good evening. The last of the big guns within range of bombarded Leningrad have been captured, and relief has finally come, in the fullest sense, to the heroic metropolis of northern Russia. The Red Army also has taken Novgorod, which in the scales of strategy undoubtedly weighs more than the capture of the Nazi guns that have been shelling Leningrad. But the relief of that city outweighs any strategic gains in the scales of human emotions. It is one of the high moments of the war for the million inhabitants of Leningrad who have carried on through bombardment, hunger, and disease, working and fighting with equal doggedness, have touched imaginations everywhere. They had to make a routine of an ordeal. Death was always present. Danger was constant. Yet they conducted their municipal life through all normal activities, maintained their schools, crowded their theaters and concert halls, operated their factories, and from time to time manned the nearby front. They hoarded their scanty food supply. Often without fuel, they withstood the deep northern cold or succumbed to it. They watched the news carefully, noting every new Russian offensive. They saw the Red Army strike in the south center, in the center. They knew that the German defenses around Leningrad were the toughest to be found anywhere on the long line. They knew they must wait. But now the time of their deliverance has come. The Leningrad victories have been celebrated by the salute of many guns in Moscow, but by nothing so eloquent as the inarticulate and grateful relief of the men, women, and children of Leningrad itself. The Russian forces driving at Novgorod killed 15,000 Germans and took 3,000 prisoners. The Germans, admitting that they evacuated their stronghold, said it was done to shorten the line. The report that before the Bolivian revolt, revolutionary leaders from Bolivia met Argentine nationalists in the Argentine home of Count Karl von Luxburg, former German ambassador to Argentina, probably is correct. And that gives a starting point for the discussion now going on as to whether the Ramirez regime of Argentina and the new Villarroel regime in Bolivia are Siamese twins born of a Nazi father. If they are, and investigation should show that the Nazis are the driving force behind Ramirez in Villarroel, then the United States and all its allies would be presented with a definite military problem of getting the Nazi enemy out of this hemisphere, doing so as quickly as possible and at whatever cost. But this is not a simple story in black and white. Even granted the truth of the report of the meeting in the home of Count von Luxburg, it still is not black and white. To put it at its worst, by present judgment, the situation is one with disturbing possibilities. The Nazis certainly have some kind of association with the Ramirez group in Argentina and some kind with the new revolutionaries in Bolivia. A coup d'etat was arranged for Bolivia with Argentine association and perhaps guidance. Others might follow in other countries. The new type of leadership now coming to the fore might appear in other lands. It might come with all the camouflage worn by the Bolivian revolutionaries, if it is camouflage. And in the end, the Nazis might have a well-established network of outposts in Latin America. And American influence in the Western Hemisphere would be reduced, American security that much lessened. And no matter what kind of peace system were to be established in the post-war world, America would be unsure of the cooperation of some of its own neighbors and that much less safe. That's the eventual danger. But it is not an inevitable danger by any means. It may not be a real danger at all. Because, as I said, the relationship between the Nazis and the new leaders of Argentina and Bolivia is not necessarily as sinister as it looks. And it probably isn't identical in the two countries. The tie-up of the Ramirez crowd with the Nazis probably is closer than that of the Bolivians. Ramirez and his associates are mostly officers, some of them trained in Germany, others trained by German officers in the Argentine. Most of the officers come from families of the great plantation owners, once so prosperous and powerful, some of them now impoverished, and as a class no longer controlling Argentine affairs. These officers detest democratic politics. They like the streamlining of Nazi control. They're at home with Nazis. If democratic politics had free play in Argentina, the cities and industrial workers would run the country, and the plantation owners from whom the officers sprang would be still worse off than they are. So they're outspokenly contemptuous of democracy and eager to wipe out every organism by which it might be practiced. Being at home with Nazis in their economic outlook, they also like Nazi ideas about world affairs. And by now it is clear that the Ramirez coup d'etat had as one of its motives the overthrow of a president who would have moved toward bringing Argentina into the war on the Allied side. So to that extent, it was a pro-Nazi revolt. Now, Ramirez and his friends sit at the top in Argentina in considerable safety, for the country is prosperous. Unemployment hardly exists, and the misery which breeds revolution or revolt is absent. If the regime is to be overthrown, it'll probably have to be by another small army clique, which presumably would be a clique intending to turn Argentina back to political freedom. But for the present, Ramirez feels secure. The one danger that confronts him is Allied action, which by imposing stern economic sanctions might stimulate some new army clique to take over. Or sanctions enforced for a long period would cause distress and so produce a popular revolt. The very prospect of such action might bring about a new coup d'etat, and the new coup d'etat could turn back from totalitarianism and reintroduce democracy. That's not to predict that the Allies are going to apply sanctions. For, as I said, the case is not black and white. Even in Argentina, one can't call the regime the child of a Nazi parent. It's friendly to the Nazis, yes, but it's not blown up to the stage of here and now being a Nazi outpost against which stern punitive measures must be taken at all costs by the Allies. To describe the relation of the Bolivian regime to the Nazis, one must understand first that Nazi ideology, like a true fascist ideology, is in two parts. The second part, we all know, it's fascism at war. But there's a first part, which in wartime is easily forgotten. It's a kind of radical socialism. It responds to poverty and injustice with eloquent indignation, and it appeals for power to the little unimportant people of a country. Hitler began as an anti-capitalist radical and would never have come to power otherwise. There was a moment in Hitler's career where, conceivably, he might have turned to straight socialism and tried to raise the standard of living by making the goods of peace. Instead, he took the road to war and cured unemployment with a vast rearmament program. No doubt a fascist, being an ardent nationalist, can take no other turning, since true fascism can only survive on the road to war. But part one, this radical part of Nazi dogma, with its outcry against injustice to little people, has an appeal to certain kinds of potential fascists in countries with or without democratic experience. It had an appeal, for example, to Huey Long, and it has an appeal to the men now in power in Bolivia. For there is rank injustice in Bolivia, And there's no need to suspect the sincerity of the new Bolivian leaders that they intend to improve the conditions of the workers in the tin mines. Indeed, it is probably true that the plight of the tin miners made their little revolution possible. All Bolivians are a long way from the war. They've never taken much interest in affairs beyond their borders. They've never enjoyed democracy. The social inequalities are great. So here is a situation where part one of the Nazi dogma would be enthusiastically received. And the real question about the Bolivian leaders is whether, having accepted part one of the dogma, they also will accept part two, and in time take Bolivia as a fascist country upon the road of war. The Bolivian leaders say they won't, that they're with the Allies, that they want real democracy. And they want to correct a crying injustice of capitalist exploitation in Bolivia. That may be what they really believe and hope, yet some of them keep company with Nazis. They're inspired by phases of Nazi thinking. So Bolivia's South American neighbors are suspicious of them, fearing that like-minded enthusiasts in their own lands might try the same game. Having mentioned the tin workers in Bolivia, who were not well off under the regime overthrown in La Paz, a natural question is whether the United States and the Allies, in taking Bolivian tin, showed any concern over the labor conditions at the mines. Here the answer is that the Fair Labor Clause of other Latin American contracts written by the Board of Economic Warfare was not in the first tin contract. But it would have been in the second contract, which was being negotiated when the revolt took place. The Fair Labor Clause, however, should not be overestimated as an instrument of reform. To be of value, it would have to be enforced by the local government, and so its effect would be more moral than actual. The alternative would be having labor conditions under supervision of foreign inspectors, which would be considered an infringement of sovereignty. Summing up, the Argentine regime is much too close to the Nazis for our comfort and perhaps our safety. The Bolivian regime at the moment does not appear to be as close, but one can't be sure. What we can do about it is a question easier to ask than to answer. As to Bolivia, we may simply decline to recognize the new regime. In the meantime, we're not so dependent on Bolivian tin, as tin from Africa is available. But obviously, not taking Bolivian tin won't improve labor conditions in the tin mines and so help restore social stability. As to the Argentine, a possible answer is sanctions. But that is a drastic answer, which will cost sacrifices to the Allies as well as to the Argentinians. Possibly the need for the sacrifices will become clear and the drastic action will be taken. The problem is being closely studied by the United States and British governments. Here is more than a test of the good neighbor policy. First of all, it's a test of good judgment by Allies in waging a global war. If good judgment calls for drastic action, that action will call for sacrifices both here and in Britain, since Argentine supplies for the war can't all be replaced. So the very mention of sanctions should help the public understand that the global conflict is not confined to the European or Pacific fronts, but that under another guise, war is incipient in the Western Hemisphere. And now a friendly message to wartime America.
Did you know that your car takes more of a beating in winter than in any other season of the year? It's true. And that's why every vital engine part and important accessory requires added care. Now, one sure way to get this extra protection is to give your car a midwinter checkup at your mobile gas dealers. Because with this service, you get free-flowing Mobil Oil Arctic for the crankcase, the oil that helps keep your engine clean and protected. Then you get sturdy Mobil greases for the chassis to reduce friction or wear. And finally, a careful checkup of radiator, spark plugs, battery, tires, and air filter. So to guard your car against the punishment of winter driving, and to save up to 10% of your gas ration, ask for a midwinter checkup service at the sign of the Flying Red Horse. For History on the March, follow Raymond Graham Swing. And for friendly wartime car service, see your mobile gas dealer.
This is the Blue Network.